So hello there, it's Dr. Danielle Arabina for Indigenous Health Med Talk, and we're joined in the podcast today with our lovely guests, Dr. Kerry Arabina, I know, my sister, and Candice Raymond, talking about the first 1,000 days Australia, the importance of the environment in which the newborn will come home to, and that's through the exploration of the household surveys. Kerry will be talking to us about epigenetics and the innovative business ideas that have been birthed from, to use the coin, birthed from the first 1,000 days. I hope you enjoy the session as much as we did.
Indigenous Health Med Talks with Dr. Danielle Arabina, yarning with innovators, trailblazers and community leaders in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health and medicine. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that this podcast may contain the voices of persons now deceased. We would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians, Yuggera and Turrbal people, from where Dr. Danielle is broadcasting, and extend our acknowledgement to the elders past and present of all our listeners.
Hello there, it's Dr. Danielle Arabina, and I'm here in the studio today live with two amazing guests. One is the lovely Candice, and the other one is Kerry, who actually has the same surname as me, which is very strange.
It is a little bit strange.
Given that she's also my sister.
So, beep, 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 beer.
I know.
There's a sister in the house.
Yeah, and that's very unfortunate for all of the listeners at home today. No, Kerry's actually very smart, but I'd like to have it on record that I was actually the first doctor in the house. Kerry has actually got her doctorate. So it was a competition who would win, and it was me. So very good.
That's right. I did say to her at one stage, though, that if you had an existentialist crisis, come and see me. And if you got a rash, you can go and see her. So
yeah, hey.
I'd prefer people to come to me with the existentialist crises, actually.
I prefer the rash just on paper or on the airways. So, first of all, Kerry, I'd like you to tell me who's your mob, where you're from, and what you're doing here today.
Okay, well, my grandmother came from Murray Island, which is a very eastern island in the Torres Straits. It is a geographical area in between the tip of Queensland and Papua New Guinea. It has been occupied for about 18,000 years. And Murray Island is famous in an Australian context because that was the place which was able to disrupt the idea of terra nullius through the land claims and the work of our peoples that was able to show a continued connection to culture and to land and to all of the elements that make up our universe. And that was absolutely fundamental to the land rights movement in Australia. And one of the things I'm really proud about that lineage is that not only were we able to change land rights in an Australian context, but now from this little tiny island in the easternmost part of the Torres Straits with about 300 people who live there permanently, we've now been having that the Mabo case and the Mabo law evident in international law, and it's facilitating land rights for Indigenous peoples the world over. So even though we've got no claim to it, just to know that that is something that we've been able to contribute to not only Australia and the world, I think is something that I'm phenomenally proud of. Yeah.
Excellent. And the lovely Candice.
Hi, I'm Candice Raymond. I am a Kokobera and Barungum woman. I also have ties to Wanyi and Gugulyalanji nations. And my family were based in Cherbourg, as a lot of other families were. And, yeah, it's all exciting. So glad that I could be here today and share some things with you. So thank you for having me.
Thank you. So, Kerry, I understand you're doing a little something-something called The First 1,000 Days. Probably it was 2017 or 2016, I became aware of this as a process that I thought was really important for doctors to know about. So can you please tell me a bit about your program?
And it's really wonderful to have Candice here today too, because whilst a lot of this has been thought about in different areas, Candice has really helped bring it to life on the ground, and I'm really excited to be here with her today. But First 1,000 Days started in about 2014, and like most fantastic innovative ideas, it came about from an absolute crisis, which was ANEMDA, which was the School for Indigenous Health at the University of Melbourne, was about to be defunded. So I was the director of that at that point in time and thought, well, what is it that we can do next? A gastro pediatrician had just come back from being over in Canada and was sharing with us information about First Thousand Days, which was an international movement focusing specifically on nutrition for women in particular in developing countries so that their children were born healthy and well and not necessarily suffering from growth stunting and the like. I sat there and thought about that, and I loved the concept of it, First Thousand Days, and having a very strong sexual and reproductive health background, understanding the importance of that period of time from preconception to conception was a really exciting initiative to think through. And when I did a look at all of the policy in Australia, particularly early childhood policy, what we found is that every single early child initiative started from birth, not from conception. So what we were missing out on was this 8 months, 9 months worth of developmental opportunities to do some really significant interventions, not only for the health and well-being of the babies, but also for their parents. And so that started me thinking. We started off with this nutrition idea and expanded it out through a series of four symposiums that we held in 2015 to become a movement in an Australian context, which has been developed and led by Indigenous peoples and which focuses on the period of time from preconception through to a child's second birthday, but really does now bring in a whole range of elements which are expanding the nutrition element to include things like cultural practices, focusing on intergenerational trauma, building business ideas and entrepreneurship. We do education and training, and we've been able to then do a whole range of social and emotional well-being initiatives that have engaged families in really powerful ways. And we've been able to then grow this movement in Australia. We've now got places over in Western Australia, Victoria, and in Queensland who are doing this work. And then it ended up growing into a movement through Indonesia and up into Norway. So there's actually the First Thousand Days Arctic Circle process, which is facilitated and funded by the Same Parliament. And in the Indonesian context, it was supported through the Australian-Indonesian Centre. And these sorts of research projects, because it was founded out of a research institution, has now become an Indigenous business 4 years and 32,000 hours later. So it's been a really exciting journey to be on, and I've learnt a lot through the process. But one of the things that I have just valued the most about it is engaging with people like Candice. And I believe, Candice, you came along to one of our short courses up there in Caboolture, wasn't it?
Yeah, I did. I believe that was around March last year, so almost 18 months ago. And it was just amazing. I'm, you know, really blessed to be a part of that, because that's where my journey started for the first 1,000 days and has since continued on from there.
And so I can't remember, how did you actually come to do the short course again?
Can you remember?
It was through the Salvation Army. So I actually do work with them doing events coordination with our local core, and they received an email that Jackie Bennett had sent out and I decided to just go along with it and just, you know, see what happens. And here we are 18 months later.
Yeah.
And Candice, you've been doing the household survey for the first 1,000 days. And I understand that you've gone out to 240 households around November last year.
Yep.
And so what was the exciting, you know, information that you received from that, or the raw data?
Oh, so much exciting stuff happened in that short, you know, 3 week period. The main one being is that people, the feedback that we were receiving is that people were excited to finally have a voice, because this information that was collected were from those families that are typically hard to reach by organisations in our region. And so for me, that was really powerful and very important to be a part of that process.
Yeah, and it was a really exciting way to be able to do research. Most of the problem formulation or policy production or programming processes in Australia often start with a problem that needs to be solved, and that's founded on a Western idea of scientific endeavour, which fundamentally poses a problem that needs to be solved. And what we've gone out and done is completely transform what the policy and programming production process looks like. And it came about for me in Canberra 1 year, which was a really cold winter, and I was doing some work with some young single mums. And I asked them, you know, what do you really want? And they said, what we want is heavy back curtains for our windows because our kids are getting respiratory problems because of their house environments. We can't afford to keep the heaters on all the time. We just want to be able to have heavy back curtains. I went back to a group of service providers and said to the people that what people want is heavy back curtains. Who can help them out with them? And we worked out that no one could actually help them out with heavy back curtains, but they could access 10 counselling sessions about how they felt about not having heavy back curtains. So the absurdity of that was something that really struck me. And so what we were able to do then was actually focus on what people have aspirations about. And I think that that was the really exciting thing. And Candice was one of the leaders and coordinators who came down to the University of Melbourne then, did some preliminary training when we talked through what was going on and how that was all happening. And then when we ended up coming back up, the training program that was run there, which was focusing on how to train family members to be peer researchers, was something that was also pretty exciting. And we had Jack Bullman and Jackie Bennett, and there are other people who are all engaged in delivering key elements of that program, after which time then everyone just got onto these iPads and went out to families and asked them all these questions about what their aspirations are and what is the aspirations that they have for their kids. And there were some fundamentally powerful things that came through from that process, really, weren't there?
Absolutely. Just a lot of people just underestimate Aboriginal Australia, really, and especially in our region, you know, and when people were asked those questions about what aspirations, they never really thought about the aspirations they had for themselves, but they definitely had thought about the aspirations they'd had for their children and what they wanted to see their children achieve. And the conversations that came from that were really awesome as well, because people were starting to think, especially that gardening question about, they were like, well, you know what, I've had this question so many times, I think I might go and plant a garden now. So that was really funny. But yeah, it was just really exciting. Like, the 3 weeks just went so quickly, and there was a lot of long days and stuff. But in particular, the one thing that stuck out the most was the impacts of transgenerational trauma and you know, how people are affected today because of that, and how even our children are affected by that, because that's, you know, a trauma that's carried on, obviously, through generations. So
I think that that's something that's really important for doctors to understand, is that concept of transgenerational or intergenerational trauma. And Kerry, I'll ask you about that a little bit, because I know that you do some work around trauma and epigenetics, which is something that I talk to my registrars about as well. But Candice, I just want to ask you a little bit more about this, the household survey. So why it's sort of important is it really gave you insight, or Kerry, it also gave you insight to the environment of which the infant was coming home to. And it was a holistic model, because I think that that's something that in the medical field, we have this very Western idea of medicine, and it's you know, it might be just your knee sore. But why is your knee sore? It might be expanded because you have to run around after your grandkids because of this or that, you know. So we try to, you know, medicine is trying to move to being more open and holistic, and I think that this survey is something that would really help doctors to understand what's going on.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think as well, it'll also help doctors to really understand how to treat people respectfully, but also culturally as well, because and also just differentiating from different communities as well, because obviously what happens in our community is different from the next, and it's about looking at the underlying issues surrounding what's actually happening to that person rather than just taking it for face value.
And that was something that we were able to see also come through in the household surveys that were done in Victoria, where we empowered household tenants who were renting from an Aboriginal housing corporation. And so what we've fundamentally have as the premise in First Thousand Days activities is that health actually starts in the home. And so the quality of a person's lived experience in their own four walls is really powerful. And what we talk about when we're thinking about health and housing, it's a house. But what actually makes it a home is also something that was coming through from the household surveys.
And what were some of the examples?
Look, people wanted to have, this is so sad, but some people just wanted to have pots and pans and an electric kettle that works and a couch to sit on. Some of the peer researchers that were doing this work, some of them experienced homelessness in the periods of time from training through to when we were doing the delivery of this, and that really just brought home to us how difficult it is for people to actually make sure that their home foundations are okay in a way which allows and facilitates them to get out to do the work. The other kinds of aspirations that people had were about being able to send their kids off to do school activities and excursions, but probably couldn't afford it at the time when it was required. And then just some really simple little things like how do people actually have leisure together, which is able to be participated in by all members of the family. And so going to the movies became something that was really powerful. But one of the big things that came out for us was just about how culturally significant people's identities were and how they needed to engage with ideas of culture again in ways that really built them up. And so the Welcome Baby to Country ceremonies are something that we've really taken to, and all of the cultural determinants of health you can really see come to play out in that particular event.
So can you tell me a little bit about that? I've seen some beautiful photos with babies and possum skins. Mm. Tell me about how that started and the impact on the community.
Well, one of the things that we wanted to do was actually really give recognition to men and women during this early period of life because of the way that the Western biomedical system is geared. What we do is we privilege the biology of a woman as the carrier of a baby rather than the cultural and the social circumstances in which she lives. And what we also do is we negate men's roles and responsibilities to the children in the early life. So we've developed up a charter which is focusing specifically on our men as our shields, and we're trying to disrupt all of that negative language that gets used to describe how our men are during that period of time. And there's also these fallacies which are around women's business and men's business. And whilst there was incredible separation, there were these nuances in the roles that men had to play during that time. And men actually were the providers of good quality nutrition. They were the ones that went out and bought the lean protein meat for women during the course. And so in terms of that, I'm looking around here, but it was a really very exciting initiative to be able to bring out in the work that we were able to do. And what we found during the Welcome Baby to Country ceremonies was that the men were the ones who were making the coolamans. They were the ones that were making the clapsticks. They were the ones who were bringing their babies across the stage. That was in the Victorian context. Did you find that up here in Queensland too?
Yeah, we actually had very similar sort of thing as well. And just being a part of that one year baby and one year child, as we call it up in the Moreton Bay region, those events, it was just really awesome because, you know, we wanted to empower our men, and the problem being with, you know, since colonisation and invasion of Australia is our men have been disempowered, and so we really wanted to really give that power back to them to be an active role in their children's lives. And, yeah, it's just been a really awesome process to be a part of because you can just see the change already, the things that are happening in our community, you know, from little things, big things grow, and it's certainly been the case in Moreton Bay.
And the other thing that we talk about for our men and women in particular is that they're not giving birth to a baby, they're giving birth to a future elder in our community. And so the quality of the relationships that are held between men and women actually have an enormous impact on those children during their first 1,000 days. And we address things like cortisol levels, but we do that through a cultural practice. We provide stewardship for quality relationships into which children need to be born. And we've got a series of principles that really do describe those things in great detail. And they are ethics and morals that are culturally derived and have a really empowering role to play within our communities and our households in particular.
So where could I find that if I'm actually looking to read about that as a doctor, those principles?
They are available for download. They're all free because we think that everyone should have them. They're available on the First 1,000 Days Australia website and www.first1000daysaustralia.com. You can find it all there. There's a couple of Facebook pages and things like that around as well. A lot of the regional initiatives have got Facebook pages. So there's one for Healesville, Latrobe Valley, up in Townsville, here in Moreton Bay. And the evolution of this program now is also something that gives us great excitement. So it's continuing on with research and evidence through NHMRC. I'm no longer with the University of Melbourne. I've decided to take the brave step into the entrepreneurial space really strongly, and I've committed to that over the next couple of years. It's one thing that we can talk about, that entrepreneurial spirit and really bringing that into play, and to be able to put your money where your mouth is, I think, is something that's really important as a demonstration. But that was something I think that people really appreciated too in the Moreton Bay region, was the idea that they could become business holders.
Absolutely. And just from a peer researcher's perspective, the opportunities that have come from being a part of this household survey, I know that, you know, some of our peer researchers have gone on to study and also gone on to, you know, be gainfully employed and are also looking at owning their own businesses in the near future. So it's been just so incredible.
And Candice, I understand you're studying as well. Has that come out of the work you've done with the first 1,000 days?
Yeah, so I'm currently doing a Certificate 3 in Addictions Management and Community Development, and have just recently started a Cert 4 in Life Coaching, which has been as a result of doing the household surveys.
Yeah, because one of the interventions that we did, again, and it's around helping people achieve mastery and achieve confidence, is that once they've identified what their aspirations are, we hook them up with life coaches and mentors to be able to achieve what it is that they want to see achieved. And that's been the case for the peer researchers as well as for householders. So in Victoria, we've seen some remarkable results as a process of engaging with a life coach. People have said it's a real white fella term. I say, absolutely, it's a white fella term, but the principles should be there for anyone, because we're not cases to be managed. I really, you know, I've got a social worker background, but I'm taking deeper and deeper offence to the idea of case management, because we're not cases. We're not numbers. We're not file notes. That's not the totality of our lived experience. And sometimes people are going to need cultural mentors. They will need peer supports. They will need someone to come along with them to find the nice dress to wear, to give them the boost that they need to go in for a study course or for a job interview. There's different ways in which these sorts of initiatives actually play out that people feel safe and secure with. But I think we've now built up about 9 businesses through the work that we've been able to do, from individual ABN holders through to the establishment of groups that are there to support each other, achieve what it is that they want to achieve. We've had pitch nights. We've set up Indige Ideas, which is a pitching event for business owners to come and they get hooked up with business mentors, and they get a small cash prize as a result of doing that sort of work. All sorts of different things are happening, and it was started out as an idea around a very time-specific intervention, and it's really changed into a movement which is facilitating social and cultural determinants of health and well-being.
Now, Kerry, I just wanted to backtrack a little bit and get you to comment. When we were talking about the transgenerational trauma or intergenerational trauma, just around the effect of epigenetics and what's actually happening, what fascinating process is happening at the very point of conception.
There's actually, it's really interesting because genetics as a field has been widely rejected by Indigenous peoples and scholars all the world over. And that is because a lot of the scientific views actually reinforce a deficit of who we are and how we be. It's really places Indigenous peoples as inferior to other peoples. But what we're doing with epigenetics is having a look at the process over the generations about the experiences that happen with grandmothers, and then how that can change gene expression to a point where you can carry particular experiences in your body and those things play out. And so again, in the policy and programming response, what we do is we just deal with the person in front of us. And in medical practice, you've got very short spaces of time with a person in that one-on-one environment. It's hard to be able to create that kind of relationship, let alone understand what's happened between different generations in the one family. And so what we really did through First Thousand Days initiatives is create an understanding of this dynamic expression of family. So Candace was just explaining to me before that her brother's grandchildren are her grandchildren. That's all related to a kinship system that's actually really difficult to describe. And certainly in the Queensland experience of where we're all from, you can tell in the 1940s there was a very strong removal process, and then the policy environment shifted to incorporate assimilation. And during those processes, people were denied their wages, they had their lands taken on them, they were forcibly removed, and all of those traumas have left genetic cues that get expressed in children's health and well-being. The other thing that's really critical is that we teach people that the first time that they hold their baby is when those cells are starting to divide and you are getting moved down the fallopian tube to embed yourself on a wall of a uterus. And what we talk about then is the chemical composition that's in the fluids in those fallopian tubes. And depending on the amount of cortisol that mothers are experiencing, that's already giving incredibly dynamic cues to that baby about how the kinds of environments that they're going to be born into, and then the way that they need to be prepared to, you know, to participate in that environment. And so I'm really wondering if there is an epigenetic answer to ADHD, for example, and it might be related to cortisol levels and the ways that babies have to be ready and prepared now. So that for us was really important. And then the other thing that's really important culturally is this idea of smoking babies as soon as they're born. And what we realised more and more now about that as a birthing practice is that there is a particular microbiome that is created in the smoke from the plants that absolutely connect people to place. And so when you're smoking a baby, you are absolutely incorporating into that baby's experience the microbiome from country. If they're born naturally, then they're getting the microbiome from their mother during the time that they're being born. And so part of the First Thousand Days was also then to have a look at what we understood by microbiome. And we've just finished doing a whole series of interviews with people from across Queensland and Northern Territory. And we're making up an animation video on what microbiome is and what our perceptions of it are and when that comes into play. So I'm really thinking that whilst many of us in academia focus on decolonising practices in institutional contexts, there is actually a molecular decolonisation process which is fundamentally important, and that is recognising that trauma carries an expression that we need to think longitudinally around a family's experience across and between different generations. And that there is absolutely no point now, there really isn't, about comparing the health and well-being of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to non-Indigenous peoples, because one's a colonising group, the other is a colonised and oppressed peoples, and we've got other ways of being able to express our health and well-being. And the fact that we're still here and we're strong and survived is actually speaks to a resilience that is quite extraordinary.
So you spoke a little bit, I mean, all of that is so fascinating to me, and you spoke a little bit about the Samoa people and what's happening in Indonesia. Can you just give me a little brief outline of what's happening for those researchers along the same vein as what's happening here?
Well, again, it's a really interesting thing because Candace really hit it on the head there before, which is around asking families about what their aspirations are rather than what their needs are. So that's something that's fundamentally changing everything. In Indonesia, when they came to the summit, there was a big focus on medicinal healing and herbs and the ways in which those alternative medicines can fundamentally heal Indigenous peoples in those regions. And that was something that had a great impact on some of the people who came along to that summit. And there was
I remember that one.
Yeah, there was a really good exchange.
A particular plant that increased the ferritin
yes.
and breastfeeding.
Yes.
Breast milk. It was really cool.
It was very cool. So there's lots of knowledges that are embedded in Indigenous people's knowledge contexts around the world, and most of them are very closely tied to the environment. I can't remember what the rest of that question was.
Samoi people?
Oh, the Samoi people. They are off tap. I'm in love with the Samoi. I really, really am. Because they are investing in universities where they're going back and learning culture. So they have got a master's degree in deer herding. They have got master's degrees in being able to do weaving and working with leather. And so the revitalization that's happening in Norway is quite profound. And much of it has come about because of the establishment of the Sámi Parliament and the leadership that's coming through from that as an institution, which is really fundamentally about governance and self-determination practices. And those things are happening in regional areas and through organisational structures. But what Candice and I have been at the forefront of, I believe, is really about family governance and really reinstating those roles and responsibilities so that there's balance and harmony between family members to grow up the children.
And, you know, so that's something that's so important, I think, for all of us doctors to understand the role and complexities of family and the holistic need for us to view health in a different way. And also as a spiritual healer myself, I find it really interesting to really, you know, we keep coming back to the need to connect to country. And so what you were saying before is that by connecting to country through rituals that we can actually populate our microbiome. I remember reading a beautiful a birth that someone did in the hospital, but they made like a little nest. So they were almost imitating that they were birthing on into the great mother, being held by the great mother, being birthed into that. But from their country, they actually got a little jar of soil. And so the aunties and granny like rubbed the baby in the soil when the bubby was born. And so for me, that's all about populating the microbiome.
Well, that's fascinating.
Yeah, no, and I think that that's going to start happening more and more. We have seen changes in the mental health legislation in both Western Australia and South Australia, and other states and territories are about to make those changes. But what it's facilitating in those places is the ability for community people to access cultural healing through brokerage monies. So it's untied. And what they're able to do now is bring Nunkaris into hospital. We're getting more and more doulas participating in parenting education and birthing practices. And there are some really strong moves about birthing on country, even in a hospital context where people are starting to take soils in from their lands and rubbing babies over and making sure that there is a very strong connection for women and men who are part and parcel of that. And that's why I think working in this time space is just so fascinating, really.
And so around that connecting to country, like as part of GPTQ, we've talked about embedding that into our wrap. We believe that's so important. So with your businesses that you're running, I understand, Kerry, you do some stuff around the cup of tea.
Oh, my goodness.
It's not a real legit cup of tea.
No, it's not a legit cup of tea. So very sadly for me, I was gardening in January this year just before my birthday and I went leg up, literally, and my foot was at a very odd angle. So I managed to break my foot, which had me on my back then for about 3 months, and I was lying there real sad way. What am I going to do? Oh, I know, I'll kick off about 7 businesses, which I did because I knew I was going to make the transition. And a lot of it has been inspired by First Thousand Days, Australia work, and the kinds of ripple effects where I can see very clearly how to connect people to country, but also then how to practice sustainability through social emotional well-being initiatives in families, but also then giving back to Mother Earth, who looks after and cares for us all. And we've got a very strong view that we're not born into a society, we're born into ecosystems. And some of that's been really aided by the role that I have at the moment as president of an international association for ecology and health. And we've been over to South America recently. We've got work going on in Africa. And there are lots of different initiatives that are happening all over the place. And I thought, well, what's my little contribution to this world? Because I'm not in academia as such anymore. I was over in New Zealand and I saw this sign and I went, gee, that looks like cup of tea, but spelt phonetically differently to the way we spell it here in Australia. And one of the things as a Torres Strait Islander woman that disturbs me greatly is the amount of plastic that is in our oceans. And once I heard that there was a plastic bag found floating in the deepest trench under the, you know, under the ocean, I just thought, well, I'm going to have to do something. So I've established a little cup of tea catering company, which is looking at putting in place things like sustainable cups, biodegradable, compostable items that would have to be with cutlery or plates or that kind of thing, but anything to do with having a cup of tea. And we're going to develop that up, and we've got logos and trademarks all going through at the moment. That is going to be sold alongside with Indigenous Eco Wholesales, which is also then looking to supply different products that come through from our peoples, both here and internationally. But one of the things that we're committing to is to have no plastic in any of the production processes or at in any of the wrappings or the packaging that comes with a whole range of goods. I just can't be responsible for the continuation of dispensation of plastic. And very sadly, you know, the medical profession happens to use a lot of plastics, and it's just really, really difficult.
That's yeah. One of the things we looked at when we go on our cultural immersions is how much sort of rubbish that we generate when we're in a community. And so we have been bringing it home and recycling. But we, as an organisation, we're really going through and looking at how we can change our practices, I think, which is really super important. So it's really interesting, Kerry, that you were talking about that, because that's something that, as I was saying, we really are interested in with our organisation. I was just reading about the ecological stress that people are experiencing, not only Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, but farmers with the drought. And they're talking about like in a mental health situation that when the land is sick, you are sick when you are so connected to the earth. So that's why I think that these practices are so important for us, because I think you said, Kerry, a long time ago, and it's embedded in my brain, one of the only things you've said to me, except I can remember a boyfriend's phone number that you made me remember, 0717127781.
Oh, my God. Let's just bring that number up now while we're online and see who answers.
I was like probably 8 and you made me remember it, and it's in my long-term memory. I was probably had a lot of fear, probably scared, you probably flogged me, said, remember it. No, she didn't do that. She did.
This is going to be cut from this particular podcast, everyone.
No, I think it's going to be left in.
Oh. I wasn't that kind of big sister, everybody. I actually used to push her around in a pram, and I used to come home from school and then she'd be sitting up there in a pram going, push me, push me. And I'd be like, do I have to? Mum would say, just take your sister for a walk. So I'd have to take her for a walk up the road.
I remember I was riding a bike and I had a spectacular stack and broke my tooth, and then Kerry got in trouble because I had to, like, I broke my tooth and Kerry wasn't looking after me, so
yeah, but it was a big hill.
I had a speed
and
wobble.
She got the speed wobbles up and my eyes
and there
got,
was a cane, there was a cane toad and I didn't want to hit it.
No,
it was all like and squashed so she, over the road, and also like put the little, it was like the little foot pedals.
Yeah, I know, she put the foot brakes on, and then I had to go and knock on this lady's door so that I could get her and lift back home to mum, who just Kerry growled me terribly.
Kerry goes, I'm in the back of the car, she goes, oh, your teeth are gone. Suffice to say, they weren't all gone. Anyway, look, back to the serious stuff. So, Kerry, what else would you like to share with us? You were saying before how awesome Candace is, and I fully agree. Mm. So let's talk her up a little bit.
Okay. Well, this is the wrap for Candace. No, it's no, don't you dare
feel shame.
Don't feel shame. No, one of the really interesting things about having made the transition out of academia into being a business owner now is the wonderful opportunity just to do some really exciting and different and diverse pieces of work. And so one of the things that Candace and I went over to the Lowitja Institute conference in Darwin, I should say, just recently, was to do consultations with people about what they understand cultural determinants of health and well-being to be. And I'm writing at the moment about how do you actually implement cultural determinants of health. And Candace managed to get a whole range of people outside and interviewed on television, which is a big thing for our mob because we're not usually fairly good with that, and just really helped and supported during those workshops. So do you want to tell us a little bit about what that was like for you? Because, again, that was your first kind of big exposure to a big international conference with a whole lot of speakers and everything, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, previously, before my husband and I had been involved with Emway, so I'd been to a few different ones, but having that was just completely different, and it was really awesome to be around people who are very much like-minded and sharing that cultural knowledge that we all carry with us. But just some of the things that I'd learnt, you know, one of the uncles that I'd interviewed, I'm sorry I can't remember names, but he has a business over in Western Australia that helps people with transgenerational trauma and, you know, when they've had issues with being in some of the missions and right. And that sort of stuff. And he
was helping them with dementia, wasn't it?
Yeah. So they had problems with dementia, so they'd had this VR headset that they could go and basically walk around this mission and that again and just being able to hear about his story and how he wanted to help all these people that had experienced the same things as him. And it was just, you know, just really exciting just to hear what's been happening in that space. And but also to hear from other people from different communities and what their thoughts are on cultural determinants of health.
One of the things that we're really thinking through at the moment, it's doing my head in, but it's a good way to get your head done in, I reckon, is even just shifting some of the scale issues that we talk about. So instead of connecting up with Indigenous peoples in Canada and New Zealand because of the common experience of how our countries were colonised, we're in implementing cultural determinants of health is reconnecting people to trade routes and song lines, and that they should be the jurisdictions that we actually map against. And so if you're thinking through data sovereignty and what does that look like, to have that bound around a First Nations language group as opposed to a jurisdiction that's a health jurisdiction, those things actually have tremendous impacts on how people live their lives. And just allowing people to be able to describe what success looks like is also fundamentally powerful. I was talking to some health bureaucrats the other day who said, I asked them, you know, what's your big success? What's the big success that you can say is at a population level? And they said, immunisation. That's great. And I said, but yes, but you're immunising Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children who are now hemorrhaging into the out-of-home care system. So is that actually a success? Or are we compartmentalising again our responses to the lived experience of those kids in their houses? And what we're doing is saying, yes, we've immunised them, but where they're growing up and the continuity of trauma is going to continue again if we don't actually get people living at home with their families, you know?
So, Kerry, just give us a summary of your first 1,000-day short course, because anyone can do that. Doctors can do it. Nurses, midwives, health workers, anyone who's works with Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people. So tell me about what would I get in that 3-day course, brief synopsis, and when there's an upcoming one.
So we've got another couple of courses coming up in October and November, and the information is available on the First 1,000 Days Australia website.
We'll pop those up on our show notes.
Yeah, but after this, what we end up doing is over a 2-day period kind of introduce people to the concepts that are involved in the First 1,000 Days. We've got 6 specific strategies that we implement. It's part of a movement. It's not a programmatic response. We really do then invite people in who are doing some of the key implementation pieces. So Candice is going to come down and talk again from the Moreton Bay experience and meet some of the other peer researchers that have been working across Victoria in different contexts too. And we hear about the impact of what it means to have been a peer researcher and what it means to have engaged a life coach and a mentor. We also focus on epigenetics, and we also focus then on men's health and well-being during this first 1,000 days period, because what we're finding is that a lot of men don't have access to any information that will help them support, make that big life transition between being a first-time father, for example, and what kind of cultural responsibilities they have during that time. The third day that I normally do then is to help people design a regional strategy to implement First 1,000 Days initiatives. And a lot of this is happening subversively. It is very, very difficult, and First 1,000 Days Australia work remains unfunded because it's so hard to get people to make a tertiary level system responsive in that early intervention space. And we are so early intervention, we're thinking about kids' health and well-being before they're even conceived, you know, and that they have rights and we have responsibilities to engage during that period of time. So I would encourage people to come along. It's life-changing for some people. And people then, you find your community of practice, and we can offer ongoing supports for people who are doing that kind of work and expand out into different areas and regions. And we've got more household surveys to do and more peer researchers to train. And we've got campfire coaches, which I've set up now, which is going to help do all the cultural mentoring. And Australian Peer Researcher Associations, that is an idea that's just about to come into fruition. So there's lots and lots of different initiatives that are spinning off as a result of this. And it's a good thing to be able to do in Australia, because what you'll end up doing is help meet your procurement targets around engaging Indigenous businesses by coming along and doing the course and then following up with people and community afterwards, help meet your Reconciliation Action Plan obligations and meet your procurement targets in each and every state and territory. It'd be a really good thing.
And also for doctors, I think it would give an insight to understanding around what Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people actually aspire to. And it might actually break down a lot of stereotypes or preconceived thoughts that some people might have.
Yep, absolutely.
So thank you very much, ladies, for joining me today. It's been a wonderful conversation. Got railroaded a bit by someone who decided to have a bit of cucumber, but...
In the middle of it.
That's all right. Pointing at any fingers, Kerry.
At least I'm not popping and locking.
Hey, I'm a hip-hop dancer. What can I say?
Oh, my days. I wish you wouldn't say that
hip-hop
out loud.
Hip-hop will make you jump. Anyway, on that note, everyone, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you again, Kerry Arabina and Candice Raymond, for your excellence in your field, your innovation and your desire to help Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
Oh, thank you. That's all we're here to do. Hey, my sissy.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us today.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe and check out our YouTube channel, Indigenous Health Med Talk. This podcast is a General Practice Training Queensland initiative, supported by Australian General Practice Training and the Australian Government.